Dr. David Spratt, who's our campaigning writer and, well, Climate Emergency Network campaigner.
Thanks, Judy. I noticed today that one of the members of the Federal Liberal Parliamentary Party said, quote unquote, there was no hurry for the party to develop a climate policy, which is sort of, I think, equivalent to a belief system which says that there aren't laws of gravity and that the party could levitate. Unfortunately, we also have, from the other side of politics, a carbon pollution reduction scheme which actually doesn't reduce emissions below the 1990 baseline on which these things are measured until 2035. That is, it's essentially put off the problem for at least 20 years in the hope that clean coal, so-called, will come into being by some miracle. So in their very different ways on both sides of politics, we have an assumption that things are not in a hurry, that we can afford to wait. I think what I want to say tonight is that, in contradistinction, the situation we face is actually beyond urgent. The science will not wait for us, and the science will not wait for the parties in Canberra. 2 years ago, the Arctic sea ice, an area of floating ice the size of Australia, in late summer started melting at an unprecedented rate. So it fell to half its normal size. And one of the leading authors of the IPCC said, my God, the Arctic's melting 100 years ahead of schedule, quote unquote. And my response was, no, it's not. Our understanding is 100 years behind schedule, because the laws of physics and chemistry, the laws of the climate, will grind on, whether we understand them or not, whether we put them in our models or not, whether we have policies to deal with them or not. And of course, we have seen that in Australia with the drying of the southern half of Australia. There was a remarkable piece of work published during the year where somebody using satellites worked out that in the Murray-Darling system, in 3 years of being this decade, some 15 cubic metres of water, some 15 cubic kilometres of water had been drawn out of the system, which was pretty scary, until they worked out that in the 5 years around that, more than 100 cubic kilometres of water had disappeared from beneath the surface. So not only was the water disappearing in the Murray-Darling, but the subsurface, the groundwater, was going as well. And the scientists who did it now tell me that it would require above normal rains in the Murray-Darling for a decade just to get the moisture back in the ground, to get the runoff so the rivers started running again. So this is the sort of urgency we now face. Someone who's just been up in the Dane Tree tells me that research up there says the Dane Tree has never been drier. We know what's happening in the wet tropics. We have a situation with the Great Barrier Reef where 1 year, and it won't be far away, there'll be a slightly warmer summer and the reef will bleach and the Queensland tourist industry will essentially disappear. We have a somewhat delusional debate in this state at the moment about sea level rises, where the government, the state government, has upped its guess on what sea level rises will be at the end of this century from half a metre to a metre, when even the scientists are saying it should be two, and seem to conveniently ignore the fact that for the current level of greenhouse gases, for the current level, in the end you'll get 25 metres of sea level rise. So this is the disjunction between politics and science. And it's not just in Australia, of course. Earlier this year, I had the privilege to speak on a platform with a visitor from Nepal called Pemba Dorji Sherpa. Some of you may have heard him, who holds the world record for the quickest ascent of Everest. And you will know that when it was first climbed, it was 4 or 5 days. You have base camp, and then camps 1, 2, 4 up, and you do one camp a day. So it's a multi-day thing. His record from base camp to Everest set last year is 8 hours and 10 minutes. And the reason is very, very simple. Half the glaciers are gone. He says, and it's half joking, it's half true, he says, I can get halfway from base camp to the top of Everest in my sand shoes. And of course, we know in Asia, that there's 1/3 million people who live on the river valleys that depend on meltwater from the Himalayan glaciers to survive. So what is happening there is an outcome that's almost beyond my moral comprehension that we would willingly go down this path. And we could talk about those sort of effects around the world. The drying we see in southern Australia, of course, is happening across California and the western United States. It's happening across Europe, so we've seen the last 2 or 3 years the wildfires in Spain and Italy and Greece and Turkey, not dissimilar to the ones that we've seen here. So the situation is already urgent. Indeed, James Hansen, perhaps the world's most well-known climate scientist, who first presented evidence to the US Congress in 1988, went back last year on the 20th anniversary to the people who didn't listen 20 years ago and gave essentially the same evidence again, and then said all the elements of a perfect storm, a global cataclysm, are already assembled, and indeed they are. The international negotiations about climate, which will resume in a very sad way in Copenhagen next week, have been concerned with trying to hold global warming to 2 degrees. We are already almost at 1 degree, and because of lags in the system, the current level of greenhouse gases would certainly produce 2 degrees, even if we desisted from tomorrow in burning fossil fuels. And yet we know that if that 2 degrees were to occur, then sea levels are likely to go up 25 or 30 or 40 metres, because that's what the climate history tells us, which wipes out all the river deltas in the world and most of the cities in the world and most capital cities in the world. And we also know somewhere between 2 and 3 degrees we're probably going to reach a trigger point where in Siberia the warming will be intense enough to start melting permafrost, permanently frozen ground, which contains, at the moment, I think, roughly twice the amount of carbon that's currently in the atmosphere. And if that should happen, it will be the end of the game for all of us and life on this Earth as we know it. And yet, despite those impacts of 2 degrees, we are now encountering and entering the period of the Great Delusion, where the negotiators are effectively turning from talking about a 2-degree rise to a 4-degree rise. And this is the great sadness that will happen at Copenhagen. I know Clive attended the 4 degrees conference in Oxford a couple of months ago, where the world's leading climate scientists laid out what 4 degrees would mean. If you actually want to look at the work, it's stunning. Just look up 4 degrees Oxford conference, and there's a whole series of papers there. At 4 degrees, we know from the climate history, there will be sufficient heat in the atmosphere. In the end, it'll take several hundred years, maybe 1,000 years, to melt the Antarctic ice sheet. Because the last time it was 4 degrees warmer than now, there was no ice sheet. And once that ice sheet is gone, sea levels are 70 metres higher. So this is the delusion which is now going to be carried out in Copenhagen, that we're starting to talk about the sort of targets that make the world unrecognisable, unlivable. In fact, some work was done where somebody surveyed all the commitments that countries around the world had made up to 3 months ago and said if every country acted to its maximum commitment, the consequence would be 3.5 degrees of warming by the end of this century. So this is why we have a problem almost beyond comprehension. I've seen a couple of jaws drop so far. You're lucky you're not getting the long version from me. It's not a crime. This is obviously the largest threat that we as a species have ever faced. Sir Nicholas Stern, in his report to the British government 3 years ago, said the impacts are likely to be greater than the two world wars and the Depression put together. I have to say that's pretty much the light version. That's the optimistic version. It is in fact going to test our capacity, and certainly for the number of people on this planet now to survive, because the impacts will be greatest in the countries who are poorest and have the less capacity to adapt and to change. The simple conclusion from all of this, which I'm sure Mark will talk about, is we simply have to stop burning fossil fuels. This is not negotiable. Kevin Rudd and Penny Wong were very pleased with their CPR essay because they said it struck the balance between the environment movement and business. That is, a sense that you can negotiate between what the planet needs and what keeps a big end of town happy. This, of course, is delusional, because you cannot negotiate with the laws of physics and chemistry. They will roll on. Stern said, we need to rebuild our energy system, and if we're going to do it, it's going to require about $2 trillion a year for several decades. That's around about 5% of the world economy. So to rebuild our stationary energy system is probably 5% of global production. Of course, we're not talking about 0.1% or 0.2% at the moment. The good news, and you'll hear more about this, is two. One, we have the technology. Two, we have the economic capacity. Our government just blew $50 billion on a stimulus package, of which 7% was green, and that was mainly BATs. On the other hand, South Korea had a stimulus package which was 81% directed towards climate measures. So we know we have the capacity. There is not a lack of money. The technology is available. What we lack at the moment is the political will, and that is precisely the problem that we're talking about tonight with the Mildura plant. It is not economic capacity, it's not technological availability, it's the political will to do it. And all I can say is this is a clear test for a government which has been in bed with the coal industry, continues to be in bed with the coal industry, a federal government which has doubled, is doubling our capacity to export coal in just two decisions they've made to increase their port facilities. There is the technological capacity, there is the economic capacity. What we demand is the political will, because it would be very sad if we lived in a society and had a government that could save banks but couldn't save the planet. Thanks very much.